You are listening to Citizen Reporter at citizenreporter.org.
Well, hello. Yes, indeed. It's a Citizen Reporter. It's a Mark Fonseca Rendeiro. It's a bicycle mark for some out there who know me that way. The podcast is back. 2019, there will be podcasts. And I'm starting to get warmed up. It takes me a while sometimes after all these years going since 2004. And then when I look back at 2004 and podcasting, when it all started, when we started, there was a Dave Brightbill, a great podcaster, a voice that I've known for years. And he happened to be in Amsterdam just a couple of days ago, and we recorded the following show. What better way to start the year, huh? Let's go.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends out there in podcast land, maybe my first one of 2019, I'm very, very pleased to have my friend Dave Brightbill here in the kitchen in Amsterdam. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Mark. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's great to see you. Yeah. We haven't seen each other in a few years.
In a few years, yeah. It's been a while, maybe 5 years or so, something like that, since I was last here. And at least I think I've snuck through here a few times since then, but last time we saw each other, and it's really nice to be in your house. It's a beautiful house, and you live in a beautiful city. You know, I think Amsterdam, it has a lot of issues. So many people, you know, so many. But you know, I think the social contract between wealth and working people in the Netherlands is a lot better than a lot of places I've been.
Hmm. Yeah, the state of inequality that is an interesting point. Yeah. No, you know, and I guess it goes with living in a place for a long time, but you know, I don't spend a lot of time saying that this is the greatest place or anything like that.
No.
I feel a great attachment to it and a love for it, but I can also criticize it forever.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and that to me tells me that I truly am home.
Oh. You know. Good. Yeah. Well, I've noticed some changes since the last time I've come here, and mainly scooters on the feet pods.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that's really a surprise to me, and I think it's not a good thing probably. You know, it's and there some of those drivers are pretty aggressive, you know, and you know, it's there's plenty of aggressive bike drivers, and but
And the bike lane is getting crowded with other kinds of devices that companies are developing. I hear about scooters. I don't really the push scooters, but they're
I haven't seen many
electric
of those. Yeah. Like the Lime bikes in the U.S., that's been a problem. It's a change in transportation, a disintermediation in a way, you know, and a disruption of the transportation system in a good way, I think, you know, but the governments haven't caught up to it yet, and the regulations haven't caught up to it. So, you know, what can I say?
Dave, we were just telling some neighbors how we know each other, and that is indeed through podcasting.
Through podcasting, yes.
And that was back in 2004, 2005.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah. We were babies in the podcasting world then.
Right.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, it was when podcasts were first getting going. There weren't a lot of corporate podcasts then. Now, of course, you know, there's every large organization, every political party in every country, every broadcast news organization has podcasts. And, you know, so... So yeah, so it's interesting. Things have changed a lot in that world, and of course the technology's changed. Like we've been talking about technology having some challenges with it today, and
classical challenges, even
yes,
software
registration. Yes, but it's interesting because I think that it's still a democratic media, and still the barriers to entry for podcasting are very small. And the same problems exist. I've been away from it for a while trying to pursue a career in research, and I've come back to it recently as a retired person. Sono in pensionato. But I I've noticed that some of the same challenges exist. And one of the things that I've always tried to do in podcasts when I've done them is to include music, because I'm a lover of music. And it's just as difficult now to do that as it was before because of licensing and
automated systems that pull your.
They find the the content, and then there's even pieces that were out of copyright. Somebody comes and claims them. Harry Fox or somebody comes along and says, "Oh yeah, but that was an arrangement that somebody did, and later on, and you're using the same arrangement even though it's a different." It's crazy. Yeah. So it's really difficult. But what I've tried to do in the past, and it seems to have worked out pretty well for me. First is to keep my head down. Mm-hmm. And not have a huge audience. And the other thing is to contact the artist directly.
Yeah.
And so I always figure, if I contact the artist directly and seek their permission to do it, then screw everybody else if they want to come after me and take my cabin in the woods away.
Yeah.
More power to them.
It took me a few years, but I do now. And this show will start with my theme music, which was composed and recorded by a childhood friend of mine who at Sparrow Recording Studios, Nick Aflito. And I said to him not long ago, I said, you produce some music, you play a lot. Maybe when you're playing, you want to make me a theme song?
Yeah.
And he said, what are you thinking? What kind of sounds are you thinking? And I said, well, give me a little, Stranger Things was big at the time. And I was like, give me some of that sort of electric sci-fi, but also give me some bass. And he whipped up something that has,
nice.
It has numerous sections in it. So I can choose actually what I'm going to use today. But I'm so thankful for that because one, no dangers in terms of whose is this.
Yeah.
And two, it was made for me. There's nothing nicer actually.
It's bespoke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It reminds me the first time I ever went, I only went once actually, but I went to Thailand and it was, I think my first trip to Asia and someone said, well, you're in Thailand. You should get yourself a shirt or a suit made for you.
Yeah.
And I said, that sounds like something a wealthy person would do, you're on a shoestring budget. And they said, well, first of all, go find out because it's not that bad. And second of all, you've never had a shirt or a jacket made for you. And I could not think of it ever having happened.
Yeah.
And I did it. And I have to say it changed my life.
I know it's really amazing to have things that are built to fit you, And I'm struggling with new shoes this week actually. Oh, so
on
the cobblestone streets of Amsterdam, but it's nice.
Yeah. But when I knew that you were coming to town and I realized that probably the last time you were here, we didn't record. We tend to do what humans do, which is sit and talk and enjoy a meal. But I thought, no, I would love to have you back on the mic. I mean, you were part of my listening diet for at least 2 years, maybe more, maybe double that much.
It was fun, and I started it too because, I don't remember which one I started for. I think I started the Radio Mac guys first, and it was mainly to market my consulting business a little bit and try to, and then I decided to close that business because I had to take care of a relative who required care and I couldn't travel and do consulting anymore. So then I had to close that business down, and I was still getting, email and calls from former clients who, still wanted my services, and I couldn't, go off to New York City or San Francisco or wherever to help them out. And what I started to do was to collect questions and then try to, each podcast, try to hit us some questions that people had asked. And if nobody asked questions that week, I'd make some up, and it worked out well too.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a couple of years after I closed the business down. And I did a local podcast for a while too, which was really fun. It didn't have the reach that the Macintosh one had, but because it's a small town. But it actually got me a job because when I needed to get a real job, because again, I was taking care of of somebody and couldn't leave my city, I was able to, use that as a kind of a reference point. And somebody had knew me from that world and knew my work and invited me to come and get a real job for a while. So it was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So look at that. The magic of this thing that we like to do. It's interesting that you say, and again, we've been watching the changes. Are you still listening to podcasts as part of your day?
Yeah, I do. I listen to quite a few of them. I know this is kind of like admitting, admitting trashy behavior, but, I really like the, Decoder Ring Theater podcast. It's a serial kind of a detective noir series and a superhero series that are both set in Canada and around the time of World War II, and very interesting. So I've been listening to those for a long time. It's a company somewhere up in, I think, in Toronto or someplace that has been doing these for about 10 years now, I guess. And so they got quite a catalog.
Yeah.
I like Hardcore History a lot. It's a favorite of mine. And a few other ones that are especially, kind of in the technology world that I'm interested in. We were talking about a couple of a video cast earlier that I'm really fond of, and I get a lot of, get a lot of juice out of, and it gets me inspired for some of the projects I like to do, because I like to tinker with electronics and try to invent new things and, figure out solutions to problems in my life and other people's lives that can be solved by engineering. So.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Those programs that you listen to, I mean, by and large, how did you find them?
Well, organically, I'd say.
Yeah.
The
organic finding is still... Yeah.
It was, usually it's because I'm there's something I'm interested in. I've got an interest in something. I'm interested in history. I think I found Hardcore History because I was looking at the history of, I think, Florence Nightingale, who was the lady with the lamp, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine had told me that one of my drinking buddies told me that Florence Nightingale had invented the pie chart. And I may have the story wrong, but I think she was the...
An office worker cringes.
Yeah. And she had invented, PowerPoint, basically, because she had come back from the Crimean War, and she had... seeing what happened with sepsis there and how, people who were exposed to had their wounds exposed to the air were getting all these terrible infections and everything. So, she went to government and, tried to use visual aids to explain, this to these politicians. And so, that's how I found, that's how I found Hardcore History, or one of the history podcasts, right? Anyway, that got me in that genre.
Yeah.
And I like the detective noir world. And so I kind of pay attention to that. And then I have some friends that do podcasts too in the States, and I try to follow them and see what they're up to and all. So it's kind of a fun world. And I know a lot of people that listen to podcasts. It's become a huge thing, I'm many people who on their daily commutes, plug in their headphones. I was talking to a friend here in Amsterdam who, commutes on her bicycle, and gave her a stern talking to because she puts the earphones on when she's riding the bicycle to listen to podcasts. And I said,
could be open earphones.
This is not a good idea.
Well, so I have and I think a lot of people listening who are in Amsterdam will know this for yourselves. The earphones don't really block. So you hear all the street sounds. Or most.
That's a good thing, yeah.
But the tricky thing is that I think noise canceling, like over-the-ear headphones, have become much more common and affordable.
Yeah.
And I think that those are lovely if you're on a plane, if you don't need to communicate with anyone.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised how many people may be wearing them on bike.
Yeah.
Although I can't always tell if the noise canceling is on, but still, it's cups over your ears.
Yeah.
I mean, that's.
Yeah, it's a bad idea. It's like in the States, people clickety clicking on their devices, and I was actually hit a couple of years ago by an insurance adjuster. I was at a red light in my truck and stopped. And he was clickety clicking on his computer, trying to figure out where he was going to go next and knocked me about a block ahead, I'm not fond of the people trying to multitask during transportation.
And it's become very common. Cyclists will have a phone in their hand.
Yeah.
And they'll be messaging or browsing.
When I was driving here today on my bike, I was looking, following Google Maps to come find you, and I know it was distracting because, at least it wasn't rush hour.
No, and there is a kind of a protocol. Like, I wouldn't say it's completely dangerous. I mean, it's dangerous, but there is a protocol. Like, we all kind of know now when someone probably, because you're behind someone,
mm-hmm.
And they're going slow. Now, there's a couple of possibilities. One is they're just a tourist kind of trying to figure out, first of all, how can I pedal regularly and not be tired? And the other thing is, where am I?
Yeah.
But the other thing that we all now know is probably going on that you can't quite see at first is this person is looking at a phone, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I just see behind them, they're just going slow.
Yeah.
But then once you pass them, and you can pass them if you're staying right, then you can have a look and you'll say, oh, yeah, they're looking at a phone. And it's up to you. I mean, most people don't say anything. You know, there are moments where I'm like, ahem, you know, but that doesn't communicate anything. So it's become normal. But it's interesting that cyclists are now affected with this. Like, you really got to text this message right now. Or, but it's mostly maps. It's mostly people carrying, looking for a place.
Well, something that's happened in my city in Tallahassee is that we've had, you know, quite a few deaths on bicycles, people hit by cars. So there's, you know, I've actually known two people who've died on, personally known people that have died on bicycles in my city. And it's really bad because, you know, there's no infrastructure for cyclists. And if there is infrastructure, it's in places where it's not needed. And when you get to the busy intersection where there ought to be some sort of, you know, method for cyclists getting through, that's where the problems happen. And there's no infrastructure there because it's too difficult. And,
and your area, car-centric. Intersections can be quite big too. Right?
Yeah. So
It's intimidating.
It's a big thing. So I cycle a lot, but I try to, you know, to cycle on secondary roads and stay off the highways. And even when I cycle from city to city in the States, I try to only go on roads that have shoulders. And I have mirrors because, you know, you can't always hear cars coming down the road, especially the electric ones now. So I want to be on a road that I can ditch if I have to, you know. So anyway, so we talked about bicycles instead of podcasting.
We're
going in the wrong direction, man.
No, but, you know, so one of the topics that I'm very interested in, the reason I ask you, you know, what are you listening to? First of all, because it's become... And I am thankful for that change over the years. It used to be if you brought up podcasting, you got a lot of confusion and just, I think many people dismissed it as some odd little thing.
Like ham radio or something.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, if I said that I wanted to dedicate my career or my time and energy to podcasting, I would get these looks of, what is that? How can you survive?
Yeah.
Why? You know. Yeah. But now there's much less explanation required because it's become so standard.
Everybody listens to them.
But one of my big sort of open questions for the future, and it applies to search on the internet in general, but it's the question of, you know, so many choices, so much creativity out there. But then the classic question, how do you get found, right? Or what happens in a future where everybody has a podcast?
So my career, when I left my consulting work and I moved into a straight job, as they say, I worked for an organization that was involved in metadata, and I was actually on the one of the voting members of something called NISO, which was the U.S. Delegate to the International Standards Organization. So I got to vote on all kinds of crazy standards and everything. But I think the secret is metadata. And I think that, you know, that there's many podcasters don't understand metadata and they don't tag their stuff properly. I think that, you know, it's all about discovery. And in the library world that I've been spending some time in lately, discovery is what it's all about. How do you make things discoverable? And it's really about describing it well. And, you know, and so then when, you know, I'm interested in, you know, a problem with, you know, the sound quality on this iPhone that I'm recording on today, you know, I can search for that. And, because people have tagged their writing and their audio and their video properly, I can find it. And then there's kind of, you know, there's a little bit of serendipity around that too, because, you know, you find things as you're heading one direction, you find something else that's really interesting to you. And but I think that's the secret. And it's, and, you know, and also making alliances, you know, with other folks, you know, trying to, you know, I believe in something called servant leadership. That's kind of my path in organizations that I've been part of. And it's, kind of leading from the rear, promoting other people and trying to make them successful. And I think when you do that, it helps build your brand too. It makes you more successful and helps you, you know, reach more of the world. So,
I remember that from, I'm going to call it our era of podcasting, which was, we would, whether it was a, you know, whatever you call it, a shout out or a mention or a recommendation, but we would talk about other shows.
Yes, exactly. Because there were so few of them.
Yeah. And it was part of the joy anyway, right? Yeah. Like, how are we all going to find each other? Well, let me tell you what I've been listening to. I've actually been mulling over, as old fashioned as it is, possibly having a newsletter where I just want to talk about what I'm listening to this week.
Cool.
And it may be useful for other people. It may just be entertaining without having to listen. But I also want to take a critical look at what I'm listening to and then also just enjoy it in a way. Because I get a lot of ideas, like you said, inspiration from what I listen to. But, you know, it's a regular conveyor belt of stuff. And it's, I don't know, I want to enjoy it a bit more, maybe share it with others. Now, you can do that in conversation, of course. But I'm wondering how to do that with more people, just a few more. And a newsletter is such an old-fashioned idea. I'm not a huge fan. And at the same time, I'm looking at it with a curiosity.
So you need to get an old mimeograph machine and, you know.
Make it a zine is what it's going to be. But yeah, the old recommendation system. I mean, blogs were like that.
Blogs were like that, And that, you know, that's a platform that's kind of, you know, changed a lot to the makerspace that I belong to in Florida. They're working right now and trying to figure out how to, you know, how to manage the content of that site, whether it's going to be a wiki or whether it's going to be a Drupal site or a WordPress site or whatever, you
know.
It's
good to know those are all still around.
Yeah, it is. It's good to know. And I'm a huge fan of the Wiki World. Wikimedia Foundation is, they're awesome. They're awesome. And I hope that they continue to exist for many, many years.
Many a podcast on this show is supported, if not participated, or with the participation of the WMF.
Oh, good.
And WMDE in Germany. Oh, good. I haven't gotten to tell you all about that.
Yeah. No,
one of my patrons of podcasting.
Well, I'm very fond of Wiki, Wikimedia Foundation and the people that work there and the work they do. And, you know, it's and also another organization that I think needs a shout out is the Internet Archive. Although they're going through some hard times, I think, right now. But a lot of their content has ended up transitioning over to YouTube, and so now stuff that you used to find on the Internet Archive is no longer there. It's you have to find it on a commercial site, on a Google site, you know. So, yeah, I was really surprised. That was, but that's what has happened, you know.
Yeah, there's a guy who appears here and there on, and I'm looking up in my phone. It's like a cyclist multitasking. He worked or works, I can't tell as a listener if he's still there, for Internet Archive. And he also appears on the Hacker Radio Off the Hook in New York to talk about what Archive is doing. And actually, he recently went on to announce a momentous occasion, because a lot of content had just been become public domain. Music wise.
Because when the new burst of previously copyrighted material became available. Pretty cool.
And so someone mentioned that he himself had a podcast, so I went looking for it, and his show is called Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It.
Oh, nice.
And I've been trying it out, and here's what I like. It's different. I'm always excited when I find a show that just sounds a little different.
Well, one of the things I get to brag about in my life is that I actually had a conversation on the phone one day with Brewster Kahle, the man who started the Internet Archive, and I don't even remember what it was about. I was researching something to do with public domain ebooks, and so I talked to him about it a little bit and learned about his theory, which I think at the time was that because of the fair use laws in the States, that if you had a copy of a book and you put it in a shipping container out in the desert and had an electronic version of it available, that you could distribute as many copies electronically as you had copies in the shipping container in the desert, you know. So that was their that was their thing for the Internet Public Library and the Internet Archive Book Project was to use that copyright law that says when technology changes that you can make a copy of whatever you have and make it available. So I think that was what the conversation was about. But it's a fascinating organization, and another one that deserves the support of everybody. I try to give a little money every year to Wikimedia and a little bit of money to the Internet Archive, because I think they're doing you know, really important work.
And I mean, what's also fascinating is their scope is so beyond, you know, many things on the internet may appear to some people as being very U.S. centric, or there's a lot of projects that are based in the U.S. for an American audience. But even just the Wikimedia Foundation, which is based in California, they do projects for so many countries in the world. Yeah. But it's not just that, right? They also consult with, talk to, support, encourage chapters in a long list of countries.
And developing countries, especially.
Amazing.
In countries that are not so wealthy. And it's really good work that they do. And they use their money wisely. They have a staff that seems to be pretty collegial and collaborative with each other, and focused on the mission as opposed to building their own personal brands and stuff like that.
Yeah. And I mean, this content, you know, archive, and we were talking a little bit about copyright and music. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of stuff that has always also come in handy when it comes to making things out of audio, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's our voice, but there's also the sounds that we can grab
and I grab images from them all the time. I'm working on a new project right now called the Grumpcast, which is
need to explain?
Yeah, no, there's no need to explain what that's all about. The Grumpcast, yeah. So I'm I hang out with some other old folks, and we get pretty grumpy sometimes about the world. So
microphones in front of them?
Well, not yet. We're working on that though. But
cameras?
I needed an image to populate the webpage for that, and I was able to find a nice one on the Wikimedia Creative Commons site. And was able to do a little modification to it and make it work for me. So.
Do you remember what where this image came from in terms of era and perhaps country?
Well, it was, I think it was...
Ancient Greece?
No, it was a crow. And I think the crow was maybe had something to do with a particular distribution of Linux or something, or, I don't remember but I do document, of course, where it came from. And
because
you want to give credit where credit is due.
I wondered what represents a grump at this point.
Yeah. Well, it was a crow with kind of a, some black clouds over its head, and, looking very, very dour and pissed off and everything. So, there's a lot to be pissed off about in the world now, so it's easy to be grumpy, and I try not to go there too much. I'm trying not to be the "you kids get off my lawn" kind of guy.
That is not your style, Dave.
No.
Matter of fact, I think there are a lot of kids just passing through your lawn.
It happens a lot, actually.
Kind of hand them a drink, I think. Yeah. I'm not sure. But so you also, I find, as you travel... as you mentioned, there's a camera set up here. You've got a mic. Well, we're mic'd.
Yes.
So you're also still documenting.
Yes.
With a project in mind.
Yes, I'm really. My goal is to. I have two goals. One is to visit as many maker spaces as I can around the globe, and talk to these folks and figure out what they're doing and how they're, how they're. Their space is organized. We find that I've been to a lot of spaces before I started recording them, and I've found that there's a lot of common problems. And what do you do about the asshole that or the misogynist that comes in, or whatever, the racist that shows up? How do you deal with that? How do you deal with people being sloppy and leaving their shit behind? And how do you deal with what's the culture like? And what's governance like? And what happens if somebody wants to come and throw money at you? How do you deal with that? Those are all, common problems that every space seems to have. So I'm trying my best to meet as many makers. I had a really nice conversation a couple of weeks ago in Tallahassee with a guy who travels around the country for the Nation of Makers, which is Nation of Makers is a organization that came out of a meeting at the White House back when President Obama was in the White House. He was interested in maker spaces and had a maker fair at the White House, and a lot of science fairs and things like that. And but this organization started there, and so my friend Joel now is traveling around the country and visiting spaces and bringing ideas from one space to the next and so on. And I had a nice sit down with him, and so I've done a few of these now, and there are still. Unedited, they're still waiting to be put together, and it's just this is the first overseas trip I've ever taken a laptop with me. Normally I bring small technology with me, portable technology, but this time I wanted to have something that I could cut video on and cut audio on, and yeah. and try to work it out. So yeah, so I'm a little, my technology stack's a little more complicated than it's been in the past. And actually, I think I have exactly the same laptop that you have there, probably, or very yeah. similar to it.
Still going.
Still going. Yeah.
It's light, but yeah, no. And you remind me of the fact, a couple of things. One is I remember, and you've just made reference to, you know, maker spaces, hacker spaces.
Yes.
For me, it was around 2007, 2008 that there had been booms before, mm-hmm. Because in Germany, we're going back into the 90s and there were, you know, Chaos Computer Club setting up. Yeah,
that was kind of the nexus, I think, of the,
yeah.
of the birth of the movement was in Germany, I think. Yeah. And
around 2007, 2008, I remember a few of my friends were involved with hackerspaces.org. Mm-hmm. And that's when I even just found a few blog posts from going to Hack DC and just seeing the space, or mm-hmm. what was then mm-hmm. called NYC Resistor, which mm-hmm. I think has changed names and locations mm-hmm. now. But it's interesting how, you know, these spaces have now existed. When they first were set up, it was remarkable and how they worked for their first few years. But now we're 10 plus years into it.
Yeah.
And that's a big question, right? Like maturity changes, yeah. problems that come up.
Yeah. And, you know, part of it is that they're mostly volunteer organizations.
Yeah.
And so, you know, volunteers have a lifespan, you know, some cases, sadly, it's a physical lifespan, but in mm-hmm. many cases, it's a commitment lifespan, you know, yeah. and people change. I just left I've been the president of my space since 2011 or so, and I just left that that leadership board because it was time for people that were younger and smarter and more interested and, you know, more connected to the culture than I was, and mm-hmm. So it was a good time.
Good that there are such people available.
It's good that there yeah. are, and I'm really looking forward to this organization remaining viable for many years to come. But it is, it's very difficult to run an organization with volunteers. And in some spaces, you know, they've managed to figure out how to collect some funding and, you know, hire management, the fab labs that are around. There's a fab lab in Amsterdam. The fab labs model usually includes paid staff in most places.
Right.
And, oftentimes they're supported by governments or by sure. Educational institutions and things like that. But yeah, it's been interesting. I've done some consulting for libraries that want to start their own makerspaces, and mm-hmm. That's been interesting. It's interesting what people think a makerspace is too, because sometimes they think that if they'll just put a 3D printer out, and you know, maybe right. if they're really doing well, maybe a laser cutter or something, and then. You know, then it's going to be a makerspace, and it's nice to put tools in people's hands, and it's great. But it's really the culture, I think, that's the most interesting, and people working together in the wacky projects that have come along. You know, and
right.
some of them are successful, and many of them aren't. But it's yeah. kind of like the 90-10 rule in R&D. You know, if mm-hmm. you get 10% successes, you're
right.
a rock star in R&D.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is what is considered a success, right? I think. A lot of, especially maybe government/chamber of commerce type, think, well, if it's a project that comes out of a maker space or a hacker space and it becomes a business,
yeah,
that's a success.
That
right?
is, yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, we in the space that I belong to now in Florida, we tag ourselves as an arts and technology space. And a lot of our projects are arts oriented,
yeah.
you know, sculptors and jewelers and you know, people who do photography and things, and so you know, it's hard to put value on that kind of thing. But you're right, you know, when you talk to the economic development people, that's what they want to know. You know, how many new business startups have you you know come? How many people are being employed because of this? You know, yeah. what have you done to make the world a better place from our perspective, which is right. you know having to do with economic development, and of course their model is. The economic development model is let's give free land and some tax breaks and some grants to a big corporation to come in and put a factory in our city. That's mm-hmm. that's kind of their model. And
let's be the next Amazon headquarters.
Yeah. That was actually, I can't believe in my little town, they actually put in a proposal to Amazon. I was like, you guys are nuts.
yeah.
You know, first of all, you're very aspirational. But secondly, you know, it's a town with, you know, the infrastructure barely supports the two universities that are there in state government, and yeah. and to bring in a giant corporation would be very disruptive. So yeah, I'm pretty glad that Amazon had more sense than that. Yeah.
So your tour will go on from here?
I'm going to be heading toward Germany next, and I have a appointment in one of the spaces in Berlin to go visit with them and do an interview there. And I'm hopefully going to a space here in Amsterdam this evening and meeting some people there and doing some video there, I hope. And then on to Italy, and I do have some appointments set up with a couple of folks that are in the maker movement there. I haven't actually been to the maker space in the city I'm going to, Bologna, yet. I'm trying to improve my language skills to the point where I can have a decent conversation with somebody there. I think it's pretty rude to go to a country and assume that everybody speaks your language. Mm. And it's, I really try my best if I'm going to spend time in a city to learn a little bit of the language and be able to Amsterdam is different because, I remember going into a store one time, one of my early trips here, and I'd been practicing Dutch, and I went into a tobacco store or something to get a strip cart for the train. So it was a long time ago. And I tried to start talking in Dutch to this young woman at the tobacco shop. And she says, "Hey, let's just talk in English. It'll be so much easier, So,
right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But I think in other parts of the world, Italy especially, I think it's very polite to try to have some Italian and do the best I can in it. And I'm getting better at it,
Yeah. I've heard you say many. I think even in this podcast, you threw in my
retired status.
Your retired status was thrown in. So I think all of our Italian speaking listeners will enjoy. And even the ones who don't speak Italian will go, "I think I know that word."
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another fun thing, right? We can just learn some words at least. And
Things. That's good. Yeah. And then the other thing I hope to do in Italy is the other project I'm working on is I'm working on a book right now, and it's a book about food. Mm. And it's an interest of mine. And I think food is local. And I think that the idea of trying to explain to people in other parts of the world what food is like, for example, in Emilia-Romagna, where I'm going, it's relatively... it's interesting, but kind of pointless because the ingredients are different, in Italy, there's a kind of flour that they used for making pasta that you can't get anywhere else, there's, meats and cheeses and, different vegetables and different fish and things that are just local to the area. So I think food is local, but I still want to document some of it because it's so interesting. And I'm hoping this will be an excuse to get into the kitchens and some of the grannies that know how to cook the delicious food. That's my goal anyway. Yeah. So, it's my excuse for it is I'm writing a book, and so maybe you'll let me come into your kitchen and talk to you a little bit and record a little bit about what you're doing.
I was just thinking what you're saying makes sense, and I like it. Food is local. And then what am I going to do though about my love of Japanese, Indonesian?
Yeah. Well, I make Thai green curry, pretty frequently at my house. And, the accommodation that I'm staying at here in town right now, there's a Korean woman there, and I was telling her that, I had attempted to make kimchi, but my Korean friends laughed at it because they said the taste was okay, but the color was really weird.
Oh, okay. It became local, basically.
So I think even, of course, when you go to Japan, and you and I have both been there, and you come back and you go to restaurants in your own city, you're just so disappointed. Yeah. It's like they've spoiled, miso for you. They spoiled sushi for you. They've spoiled, because
give me some of that magic.
Yeah.
So we can aspire to that. No?
So yeah. So I try to look for the local food where I go, and even in my own city, we try to buy local. There's a wonderful thing now happening in my city that's an online market for the growers, and so I may be here too. I don't know. Mm. But
direct, that you can get it direct.
The way it works is that the farmers will. There's about 100 or so farmers who participate in this market, and they, end of the week they let the market know electronically what they're going to have available, and they not only produce but other edibles too. And then, on Sunday mornings, the market opens up, and usually the good stuff is gone in about an hour, and. And then on Thursdays, the food is distributed. It's there's people that collect the stuff from the farmers and bag it up. And there's different ways of delivery. Some people go pick it up. Some people have it brought to them. And it's nice. So local produce. We have a new product that's just come out, which is, grits are a big thing in the South.
Right,
and
right.
So we have smoked grits now. And the farmer that's growing these grits is actually smoking them over hickory and before he grinds them. And they, it's interesting flavor. We're trying to figure out what to do with it,
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, between the vegetables, the audio video content, the traveling,
I'm having a pretty good life,
Yeah,
I'm hoping my health stays well for a while longer, and I'm able to do a little bit more of this. Life is good, and I'm very lucky, very fortunate, and fortunate to know you. Thank you.
The feeling is mutual.
Yeah, and I'm fortunate to be in this beautiful city, and. Eat the delicious food of Amsterdam. People don't typically think of Dutch culture as being a food culture, but it's a huge food culture,
yeah.
I think.
And, it's a newer development.
Is that right? Yeah.
A friend of mine who's been here 20 years said, you should have seen 20 years ago. Well, I'm almost at 20, but still, he was talking about the 90s.
So it was a stomp pot and, stuff like that. Yeah.
And it was unhealthy as well. Yeah. That's something that's also changed. The city kind of figured out how to enjoy food. But not hurt yourself.
Yeah.
Fries are good.
Yeah.
And they continue to be, but it doesn't have to be the only delicacy that people are enjoying.
Well, I always get a cone of fries when I come to come to Amsterdam or to Brussels or to Antwerp or wherever. Yeah. But I always only eat like a third of it and then end up, composting the rest in the garbage can. So it's, I just can't do it too much of it. It's just too much of a good thing, but it's nice. It's a nice taste to have.
The city has changed and we all get to enjoy some of the the benefits of that.
Yes, of course. Say. Yeah.
Dave, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here. Yeah.
And great to hear your voice on this podcast. I'm going to enjoy it listening as I cycle around town.
Oh, good.
And that's a funny thing in the end as well. I mean, there's an audience, however many, but there's also you yourself as a listener of content and your own content.
And for me, that's the most important, it's really fun and it's... it kind of helps when you have fading memories as an old person to have a catalog. So have the back catalog of your memories. So, yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for the time today. And thank you for showing me a little bit of your city. And thank you for helping me with my technology a little bit. And I'm going to follow up on some of the things you suggested. So thank you for that, too. And look forward to the next time.
Huh? Yeah, likewise. Yeah, yeah. Here's an audio handshake.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, there's video.
There's video happening, too. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And, thank you, Mark.
And let's do this again next chance we get.
I hope so.
Davey Brightbill is a podcaster, an educator, a cyclist, a hacker, and a human I'm so happy to call my friend. Before I leave you with the wonderful sounds of Neighbor, the band, I wanted to make a few small announcements. I think the biggest one should be that this podcast, Citizen Reporter, as well as Source Code Berlin, the program that I've done in cooperation with Wikimedia Deutschland for the last few years, that has currently on hiatus until I figure something out, but it's all now on Spotify. I don't know how many of you are Spotify users. I happen to be. I'm not saying you should be, but it is impressive. The entire archive, going back to 2004, is there on Spotify, and it plays quickly, easily. It looks good. Thankfully, I occasionally manage to include nice images with my descriptions of shows. So if you use Spotify at all, maybe look in the podcast section and follow this show or tell people that they can, because it really makes content from the past relevant again, which I love, and I firmly believe that it can be. Other things include the program Babel of the Bastards, which is a sort of side program I do with Isaac Simon on social science and Game of Thrones. There's a few episodes that have been in the vault that have not yet been released. They're coming out, and I'm going to put them in this feed. So beware and maybe give it a chance. Isaac and I will be producing more kinds of podcasts, slightly different theme coming up. But, we understand that not everybody likes some of these things, and we try to make it as accessible as possible. You don't have to be a fan. Theme music on today's program started with the Citizen Reporter theme, which is composed and recorded at Sparrow Recording by Nick Aflito, the great musician, recording mind, studio. He's many things, but he's above all the theme music of this podcast. And also you're hearing the sounds of Neighbor and the voice of Maite Larburu, a longtime friend of mine who also allows me to use her music, and I love it. And I love sharing it with you. I'll be back real soon with many more podcasts. Citizen Reporter will march on, or walk on, or run on in 2019, because I love this. This is what I've been doing for so many years, more than 14 years now. So stick with me, and I'll see you real soon. See ya. See ya. What cannot be, cannot be.
And then we lost our train line after Hurricane Katrina. They said that it wasn't safe to bring the trains over the bridges anymore. Of course, they transport nuclear weapons over the bridges, you know, so on trains. So you know, it's you know, I don't understand.
But there had been passenger traffic.
Oh yeah, yeah, we had a tri-weekly. Yeah. Once a week they tried to get through. No, I think it was three times. It was 3 times a week, and
tri-weekly.
It was a good service, you know. It was the
tri-weekly basis. It was the sunset.